So, of course, it's very easy to have our standard procedure for class when we're commemorating Bhaktivinoda Thakur, because the song that we sing at the beginning of every class is written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And Prabhupada says that this song gives us a complete picture of Vrindavan. So when we're singing Jai Radha Madhava, we can meditate on Bhaktivinoda. It's such a simple song, only four lines. But how he wrote this, Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari, how Radharani is with the husband of the goddess of fortune. And they are enjoying in the groves of Vrindavan. They're not enjoying in big palaces like in Dwarka, but in simple opulence, which, you know, even those who have big palaces, they like to have their country estate where they go for more intimate enjoyment. Gopi Jana Balabha. So Krishna is not only enjoying with Radharani, but with billions and billions and billions of gopis. Giri Varadari. But it's not that he's some ordinary person who's simply has so many girlfriends and so many queens. He's the lifter of Govardhan Hill at the age of 7 and one little finger. So he's God, an extraordinary person. His activities are not material. Yasoda Nandana. So Krishna loves to be called by the names associated with his devotees. And he has so many rasas with his devotees, not only his rasa with Radha and the gopis, but the loving relationship he has with Yasoda, with Nanda Maharaj, with Subal, with Raktak, with the cows. Prabhupada says he's embracing Radharani and he's embracing the cows. Yasoda Nandana, Braja Janaranjana, everybody. Braja Jana, all the people of Braja, Ranjana, he's giving them so much pleasure. So it's not just that Krishna wants our service, that Krishna wants us to please him, that he's a pleasure-sucking person, Bhoktaram Yagatapasam, that he's the enjoyer, and he's simply enjoying our service, and we're getting nothing. That's the view of the despot in this world, the tyrant in this world. They're simply taking the service and the pleasure from everyone. They're giving nothing. No, Braja Janaranjana, he's giving pleasure to everyone. And it's, although Jana means person, he's also giving pleasure to the cows. It's described in Ananda Vrindavan Champu how the calves, they're hungry. They want to go drink their mother's milk. And their mothers are in front of them. But Krishna's behind them and they want to stay with Krishna, so they're stuck. They can't go in either direction. The cows, they won't give milk to their calves until they see Krishna. The flowers, as soon as Krishna sees them, they are blooming. Every blade of grass is waiting for Krishna to step on them and to feel the soft touch of his feet. So Braja Janaranjana, Krishna is pleasure-giving, and he's giving every living entity who's connected with him unlimited pleasure. So Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Balava Giri Varadari Yasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari. So Yamuna, by the river, Tira, the banks, Vana, in the forest, Chari is enjoying, is wandering. He's wandering. Where is his supreme abode? It's by rivers and forests. It's rural. Vraja also means pasturing grounds. His ultimate place is in the country, in simple opulence. And there he's enjoying his pastimes. And Prabhupada says this is a complete view of Vrindavana. So we can just meditate on Bhaktivinoda Thakur, writing this song, of course, with his hundreds of other wonderful songs that we sing. So as we sing this song, we meditate on Srila Prabhupada, who told us about this song, on Krishna, Radharani, the gopis, the Jamuna River, the residents of Vrindavan, who are being described in this song, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who wrote this song. And as this is also the disappearance day of Gadadhar Pandit, we can also meditate as we sing this song on Gadadhar Pandit himself. Gadadhar Pandit, of course, is the is Radharani. Radharani in a little different mood. She, as Gadadhar Pandit, he's in a mood of supporting that Krishna is in Radharani's mood. So he's teaching Mahaprabhu how to enter into the ecstasy of Srimati Radharani. And although Mahaprabhu went to Vrindavan, Gadadhar Pandit never went to Vrindavan. But Gadadhar Pandit participated in the Rath Yatra, which is emotionally bringing Krishna. When Krishna is in an ecstasy of meditating on Vrindavan, he appears as Jagannath. When Balaram and Subhadra are in an ecstasy of meditating on Vrindavan, they appear in that form, like a turtle with their limbs withdrawn and their eyes very large, stunned. So in that form, Gadadhar Pandit participates in bringing them emotionally to Vrindavan, represented by the Gundicha temple, and represented by how Radharani felt when she saw Krishna and Balaram Subhadra at Kurukshetra, when she saw that Krishna was at Kurukshetra and she wanted to bring him back to Vrindavan. So in honor of Gadadhar Pandit, as we're singing this song, we can meditate on being at Kurukshetra. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati says that to serve Radharani at Kurukshetra is to facilitate her in her time of greatest need, where she's seeing Krishna, but she can't have the kind of relationship she wants to have with Krishna. She can't, someone you love, you haven't seen for a long time, and now you're seeing them, but it's at some formal meeting, and you can't really express your mind, and you can't really do what you want to do. So she wants to bring him back to Vrindavan. And we can also sing this song in that mood. We can sing this song in the mood of being at Kurukshetra, seeing that Radha and Krishna are there, seeing that Mother Yasoda is there, but they cannot have their normal relationship with Krishna. We're wanting to bring them together, but Govardhan Hill is not there, and Jamuna Tira Vanachari is not there, and not all the residents of Vrindavan, Brajajana, Ranjana, they could not all come. The cows could not come, the trees, the birds, the deer, they could not come. So Krishna come back to be with, so you can be Brajajana Ranjana, and so you can Jamuna Tira Vanachari, and so you can be Kunja Vihari, so you can enjoy in the groves of Vrindavan. So if we sing in that mood, of the mood of Gadadhar in Puri, wanting to bring Krishna back to Vrindavan, in the mood of Bhakti Vinod, who of course lived at Sunanda Sukhada Kunj across the Jalangi from Mayapur, in the mood of Srila Prabhupada, who was trying to bring this vision of Golokdham to the whole world, and in the mood of meditating on Radha and Krishna, then we will be entering into the Bhagavatam verse for today, and we'll be entering into a meditation on Bhakti Vinod and Gadadhar Pandit. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Baba Giri Gopi Jana Baba Giri Varadai Jasoda Nandana Braja Janandana Jasoda Nandana Braja Janandana Jamuna Tira Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari
Giri Maharajami Gopi Jana Mama Giri Maharajami Jasodanandana Vraja Jananandana Jasodanandana Vraja Jananandana Jamunati Jamunati Ravanachami Jayam Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajakacharya Asatara Sata Sri Srimadas Divine Grace Esi Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajakacharya Satara Sada Sri Srimad His Divine Grace Bhaktivinoda Thakur Ki Jai. Gadadhar Pandit Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrind Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavindam Ki Jai Maturdam Ki Jai Navadrup Mayapurdam Ki Jai Jagannath Puridam Ki Jai Ganga Maya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhaktivrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale. Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pacharane. Nirvase Sasunyavani Paskachyade Sitarane. Namo Bhaktivinodaya Satchidananda Namane. Gaura Shakti Swarupaya Rupanuga Varayate. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So this is a Skype class, June 30th, 2011, from Hilo, Hawaii, on the disappearance day of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Gadadhar Pandit, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 10. Departure of Lord Krishna for Dwarka. These are the prayers of the women of Hastinapur. Text 30. Eta param shritvam apastapeshalam. Nirasta sochambata sadhu kurvate. Yasyam grihat pushkara lochana patir. Najatvapaityatriti biridishprisam. Please chant. Etaha. All these women.
All these women.
Param.
Param.
Highest.
Highest.
Streetvam.
Street.
Womanhood.
Womanhood.
Apastapeshalam. Without individuality. Nirasta. Without. Socham.
Purity.
Bhattasadhu. Or auspiciously glorified. Kurvite.
Do they make?
Yasam.
Yasam.
From whose?
From whose?
Grihat.
Grihat.
Homes.
Homes.
Pushkala Lochanaha.
Pushkala Lochanaha.
The lotus eyed.
The lotus eyed.
Patihi.
Patihi.
Husband.
Husband.
Najatu. Never at any time.
Never, never at any time.
Apaiti.
Apaiti.
Goes away.
Goes away.
Ariti bihi.
Ariti bihi.
By presentation.
By presentation.
Riddhi.
Riddhi. Riddhi.
In the heart.
Sprishan.
Endeared.
Endeared.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. All these women, so the women they're referring to are the women who were kidnapped by Bhomasura and that Krishna rescued and married. All these women auspiciously glorified their lives despite their being without individuality and without purity. Their husband, the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. So before we go on to the purport, I just want to look at this word that Prabhupada translates here as without individuality. Apastapeshalam. So I asked Bhanu Swami and Hridayananda Maharaj, what does this mean without individuality? And Bhanu Swami referenced Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, which says the same thing as Sridhar Swami's commentary, which means apastam means gone, and peshalam means good fortune or auspiciousness or independence or following one's will. So it can mean that your good fortune is gone, your auspiciousness is gone. It can also mean that you've given up your independence and following your own will, which seems to be the definition that Srila Prabhupada's giving here, meaning surrendered. Hridayananda Maharaj said that we start from the word before, which means womanhood, and then here, Hridayananda Maharaj describes that apasta also means discarded or gone, and peshalam he defines as craft or charm. So he says, how do we get giving up your charm to giving up your own independence? He says that the queens were very attached to Krishna, yet they gave up all vanity, craft, etc. They gave up any selfish will in their loving service to Krishna. So that's their take on it. I don't think I can add anything further, but I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, I'm going to read the translation again, then go on to the purport. All these women auspiciously glorified their lives despite their being without individuality and without purity. Their husband, the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. Purport. The devotees of the Lord are pure. So what Prabhupada's going to discuss in this purport, we might just back up a little bit before we read it, is the verse here is saying that although they didn't have purity, they didn't have soksham, and they didn't, they gave up their will, their charm, still they're sadhu. Still they're all sadhu. They're all glorified. Sadhu means a saintly person, also means glorified. So these women are glorified, although from a material point of view, they were without auspiciousness. So what Prabhupada is going to discuss here is how the devotees are glorified, even if from a material point of view, they're not on a very high level. Okay, let's read the purport. The devotees of the Lord are purified souls. As soon as the devotees surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord sincerely, the Lord accepts them. And thus the devotees at once become free from all material contaminations. Such devotees are above the three modes of material nature. There is no bodily disqualification of a devotee, just as there is no qualitative difference between the Ganges water and the filthy drain water when they are amalgamated. Women, merchants, and laborers are not very intelligent, and thus it is very difficult for them to understand the science of God or to be engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. They are more materialistic, and less than them are the Karatas, Hunas, Andaras, Pulindas, Pulakshas, Abhiras, Kankas, Yavanas, Kasas, etc. But all of them can be delivered if they are properly engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. By engagement in the service of the Lord, the designated disqualifications are removed, and as pure souls, they become eligible to enter into the kingdom of God. So that's Prabhupada's giving the general philosophical point, and now he's moving to these specific people. The fallen girls under the clutches of Bhomasura sincerely prayed to Lord Shri Krishna for their deliverance, and their sincerity of purpose made them at once pure by virtue of devotion. The Lord therefore accepted them as his wives, and thus their lives became glorified. Such auspicious glorification was still more glorified when the Lord played with them as the most devoted husband. So again, these women, these 16,100 women, were kidnapped, and they were no longer marriageable by Vedic standards. So by Vedic standards, a man and a woman should not have relationships with others before marriage. Although a man could have more than one wife, and sometimes a woman could also have more than one husband. Draupadi had five husbands, Marisha had 10 husbands, there's one woman in Bhagavatam who had 49 husbands. But still the idea was that one should not have a relation outside of marriage before marriage. Either man or woman, not just that was the criteria for women, it was a criteria for everyone. The man was supposed to be brahmachari before marriage. So these women had some relation by force. They were kidnapped by force. And in there are many strict societies today where even if someone is raped, they're considered unmarriageable, which of course is not very nice. So these women were considered impure, but Krishna didn't accept them on the material level. He accepted them on the spiritual level. And therefore they became glorified, A, by his acceptance of them, Prabhupada says, and even more glorified when he actually lived with them and associated with them as a husband. And now Prabhupada's going to describe how Krishna lived with them as a husband, which is also, of course, described in this verse, that na jata pat yatri ridish prasam. Ridish prasam. Sprisha means to touch, literally. Ridish prasam, to touch the heart. Prabhupada is using the word endeared, to please their hearts. But we even use this expression in English, oh, you really touched my heart. So what does that mean specifically? You know, we in psychology, we often say, all right, if you say somebody's responsible or somebody's this or somebody's that, what is their specific behavior? What we say in counseling is, what can you see with a camera or hear with a microphone? So here Prabhupada's taking the general vague word from the verse, ridish prasam, to touch the hearts or to please the heart. And of course he even expanded it in the verse where he said he always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. And of course in the verse itself also it says he never left them at home. So Prabhupada expands on this in this last paragraph of the purport. So let's read that, where Prabhupada says here, the Lord used to live with his 16,108 wives constantly. He expanded himself into 16,108 plenary portions, and each and every one of them was the Lord himself without deviation from the original personality. The Shruti Mantra affirms that the Lord can expand himself into many. As husband of so many wives, he pleased them all with presentations, even at costly endeavor. He brought the Parijata plant from heaven and implanted it at the palace of Satyabhama, one of the principal queens. If, therefore, anyone desires the Lord to become one's husband, the Lord fulfills such desires in full. So how did he touch their hearts? First of all, he was with every one of them. Of course, it's interesting that Prabhupada says here constantly, and the ladies of Hastinapur also say he never left. But of course, he did leave. Every day he would come into one form and do his royal business in Dwarka. And sometimes he would also leave and go to Hastinapur. He would go visit the Pandavas sometimes for months at a time. Of course, he was at the Battle of Kurukshetra. And at least once when he went to Hastinapur, he took all of his queens with him for the Rajasuya sacrifice. But the point is that, as we said before, it wasn't that Krishna was only with each wife once every 50 years, but he was staying at the home of each wife every day. How else did he please the wives? By giving them gifts, and giving them gifts even at great endeavor. He went all the way to the heavenly planets to get this Parijata tree for Satyabhama. Eta param shritvam apastapeshalam nirastasocham batasadukurvate yasham grihat pushkaralochana pati na jatapatya ritibir ridis prasam. All these women auspiciously glorified their lives despite their being without individuality and without purity. Their husband, the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. So here Prabhupada's explaining that there's material qualification and spiritual qualification. Now, on one level, material qualification is indicative, to some extent, of something that is at least quasi-spiritual. How does one get material qualification? How does one get a higher body? One gets a higher body by engaging in good karma. And what is good karma? Good karma means that you're closer and closer to sattva-gun, to the mode of goodness. The higher you get to the mode of goodness, the better your karma is. Sattva-gun means you do the right thing for the right reason. Rajagun means you do generally the right thing, but for the wrong reason. And sometimes you may do the wrong things. And in tamagun, you do the wrong things and with ill motives. So the more you do the right things and the more you do the right things for the right purposes, the higher body that you get. Why? That's logical. If you're running an establishment, the more that your employees do the right thing and with the right motive, the more facility you'll give them. And the more they do the wrong things, or even if they do good things with the wrong motive, the less facility you'll give them. You give a person responsibility as much as you can trust them. A higher body, what we mean by a higher body, is a body that's less under the control of material nature, a body that has more freedom. The more freedom that you have, the higher the body that it is. Freedom means that you're not constrained by the modes. Like an animal is constrained by the modes of material nature of that body. A cow cannot decide to kill an animal for food. A cow it has to eat grass. It can't think otherwise. A tiger can't decide, I'm going to be a vegetarian. You know, a dog cannot decide, I'm going to be celibate and I'm going to be a brahmachari. An animal doesn't have that facility. It's forced. The modes of nature are forcing. And even among human bodies, some human bodies are more tightly under the modes of nature than are others. So comparing looking at the human bodies, the man is more free. Therefore, we find that there are more criminals among men. Why? Than among women? Because they have more freedom. They have more freedom to follow the law. They also have more freedom to break the law. Right? The woman is more controlled by the modes of nature than is the man, biologically, psychologically. And then we find among both men and women that the higher castes, that those who are inclined to philosophy, to poetry, to science, they are persons who also have more freedom of thought. Those who are inclined to righteousness, to ethics and morality and ruling, they also have more freedom than those who are just interested primarily in sense gratification or in wealth. So among the, there's also distinctions. There are women in the higher classes and women in the lower classes and men in the higher classes and men in the lower classes. And then, of course, above the human beings are the demigods, who are even more in the mode of goodness and have more freedom. And of course, the demigods have much more power. So in one sense, the higher body you have means that you already are in a situation where you're closer to sattva gun. Sattva means truth. Krishna is said to appear in the Satvata dynasty. So you're naturally closer to the truth. Prabhupada talks about consciousness being covered. He talks about the levels of covering. And he describes that the least level of covering is that of the demigods, that the demigods are naturally very Krishna conscious. They're naturally very Krishna aware. The basic feature of a demigod body is sattvagun. The basic feature of a human body is rajagun. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita purport, Prabhupada says that if you are purely in rajagun, you will take birth on earth as a rich person or a king. And the animals are primarily in tamagun. Of course, again, there are varieties of humans, varieties of... These are general statements. So the person easiest to become Krishna conscious is one in a demigod body, or the higher demigods, those the celestial rishis, those in the planets of Mahaloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, they can most easily become Krishna conscious. They're practically speaking already Krishna conscious. They're a few millimeters away from pure Krishna consciousness. And the lower you get, the harder it is, as Prabhupada says here, more materialistic, so very difficult. So if by one's previous activities, one has engaged in things under the lower modes, then one is covered by those lower modes, and that makes Krishna consciousness difficult. The degree of covering is greater. Just like if you want to see the sun. So if you have a clear window, you can see the sun very easily. If you have a translucent window, the kind of windows that there are in bathrooms, then seeing the sun is more difficult. And if you have just a wall, then seeing the sun is impossible. So the animals are like a wall, human life is like a translucent window, demigod life is like a clear window. But anybody who goes out of the room can be in the sunlight. And that is possible for anyone. It is even sometimes possible for an animal, like the dog of Shivananda Sen, or like some of the devotees of Lord Ramachandra, like Jatayu, who was a vulture, not only an animal, but a lower level of animal. So that is possible for anyone. We should be aware, however, that if by our previous karma, we are in a lower material position, that Krishna consciousness may be more difficult. Another analogy can be, you know, to come out of the room, you have to walk through the door. But how far away are you from the door? So some people's bodies, some people's position, put them so they're right next to the door. And other people's bodies, other souls' bodies, they're very far from the door. So one can complain, oh, this person has it easier to become Krishna conscious than I have. And, you know, that's true. Prabhupada's admitting that in this purport, that depending on our birth, Krishna consciousness may be easier for some of us than others. There's no disputing that. Some of us have a situation where, again, by our previous choices, it's very easy. And some of us, a situation by our previous choices, it's moderately difficult. And each of us is an individual. You cannot put all women into the same category. There are Brahmin women, Kshatriya women, Vaishya women, Sudra women. And then more and more and more subcategories. And we're each an individual person with our individual mix of karma. You know, I know of some people in female bodies who are much more uncovered than some people in male bodies. It's, you can't even put all Brahmin men into the same category. We're each individuals. And there's combinations. Each of us have certain things in our life that make Krishna consciousness very easy. And we have certain things in our life that make Krishna consciousness difficult. And those certain things may be bodily propensities or they may be mental propensities. We may have certain mental habits that make Krishna consciousness more difficult than somebody who has different mental habits. And the things in my life that make Krishna consciousness easy, those same areas in someone else's life, may make Krishna consciousness very difficult. You know, for example, some people find celibacy extremely easy. Other people find celibacy extremely difficult. Some people find respecting others extremely easy, and other people find respecting others extremely difficult. And there may be a mix. One person might find celibacy very easy, and being respectful and inoffensive extremely difficult. I know of offensive celibates, and I know of inoffensive people who have a very hard time controlling their sexuality. So there's different, in different ways, depending on our past actions, And depending on our past actions, if we have certain areas where Krishna consciousness is difficult, rather than being envious of those who by their own actions find Krishna consciousness easier in that situation, we should simply be honest enough and humble enough to realize that maybe I have to do more work and more austerity in this area than other people do. And that's just the way it is. You know, one can grow a garden anywhere. Literally, one can grow a garden anywhere. But in some situations, it may require a tremendous amount of difficulty. Like here in Hawaii, it's easy. The soil is fertile. Here in Hilo, where I am, we get a lot of rain, a lot of sunshine. The weather is warm. You can grow practically anything. Of course, you got problems with snails and slugs. But pretty easy to grow almost anything. Now, if you're out in the desert, like I've been in the desert in the southwestern part of America, and I've been in the desert in Israel, you can still grow things. I mean, we grow a lot of food in America, in Southern California. How do they do that? With irrigation, with building up the soil. You know, I've gone through the Negev desert in Israel, where there's huge pipes, 2 feet in diameter, bringing water into the desert. And they've literally made the desert bloom, bringing in fertilizer, compost, cow dung, and water. And they'll create a whole farm that's supporting hundreds of people right in the middle of the desert. But you have to keep working at it. And as soon as you don't work at it, then it's going to go, you know, punir mustika bhava. Again, you're going to become a mouse. It's going to take, it's harder to establish it. So people complain that it's not a level playing field. I mean, I know this is a controversial topic, but just like right now, New York State has approved that homosexuals can marry. And we hear this sort of thing in ISKCON also. We hear, well, if you're heterosexual, you don't have to be celibate. You have the option of marriage. Why can't homosexuals do the same thing? It's easier for the heterosexuals. And our answer is yes. It is easier if you have a heterosexual orientation than a homosexual orientation. It's a fact. Krishna consciousness, at least in the area of controlling sex life, is going to be easier. That's true. We don't dispute that. But that doesn't mean you can artificially level the playing field by changing the parameters for how to be Krishna conscious. Everyone has to go through the door of bhakti. And going through the door of bhakti may be a smaller journey for one person than another. There's nothing that one can do to change that. It's not that if we just say, well, we're artificially making it, but it doesn't. Then you're not entering into bhakti anymore. And it's obviously we should have compassion for people who struggle with something that's not a struggle for us. But we should also admit that everyone I know, at least, has a struggle with something and has something in their life that's not so auspicious for Krishna consciousness. Just like these ladies did. They had so many things that were not auspicious for their Krishna consciousness. So rather than making that as an excuse, just surrender to Krishna. Daivyeshu Gunamayi Mama Maya Duracheya. Oh, this Maya is so hard. Undoubtedly it's hard. Without any doubt. Mama Maya Duracheya. Why so hard? Daivyeshu. Because it's Krishna's divine energy. It's not just some minor thing. But yet, as Krishna explains in the end of the third chapter, the soul is higher than dull matter. The soul is higher than the intelligence, higher than the mind, higher than the senses. We can conquer. Ha ha ha, we conquer by Mayam etam taramtite. I will, how will you do that? Mam evaye prapadyante, by surrendering. Then it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter how far you are from the door anymore. Because we're not making an effort to go to the door by our own endeavor. When we surrender, which of course is done by our own endeavor, when we surrender, then the whole ocean of material life, instantly, it becomes like the water in the hoof print of a calf. One may have so many disqualifications. Look at this list here. We may be a whole lot of them. We may be a woman and a yavana. Oh my goodness. We're not even a shudra woman. Whoa. You know, we're like a tribal. So many disqualifications. One may have poor health. One may have a disturbed mind. One may have so many bad habits. Well, everything can be against you. It doesn't matter. As soon as one surrenders, as soon as one says, yes, Krishna, from this day on, as Prabhupada says here, as soon as the devotees surrender under the lotus feet of the Lord, sincerely the Lord accepts them, and thus the devotee at once become freed. The designated disqualifications are removed, finished. What is the only qualification? Sincerity. Doesn't matter, whatever one did in the past to get one this kind of body or that, whatever one's done in this life, doesn't matter. Just, my dear Lord, from this day on, I am yours. You can do with me as you like. Tatenu kampan, if you feel that you have to put me through a trial of fire in order to purify my designation, so be it. You are always my worshipful Lord, unconditionally. I simply want to please you, and I'm going to stay by your lotus feet, come hell or high water. Whether you embrace me, whether you trample me, whatever you feel is good for me. And I recognize, Lord, that because I have done so many sinful things in the past, it may be somewhat of a difficult journey to purify me, but it doesn't matter. I want you, and I'm willing to go through anything to get you. Then such a person, with that sincerity, the material disqualifications are gone. They're not considered. It doesn't matter. They're finished. And then one is not only a glorious sadhu, one not only is a sadhu, but the Lord will want to personally associate with one. The Lord will come and accept, yes, you are mine. You are my beloved. And Krishna will want to be with us. The Atmaram and the Aptikama, he will have a desire to be with us, and he will have a desire, Riddhi Sparsha, to touch our heart. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur envisioned that all the people of the world would be in this situation. When will those fortunate Americans and Russians and British and everybody be singing Jaya Sachinandana, Jaya Sachinandana in Mayapur Dham? And indeed, it's happened. You go to Bhaktivinoda Thakur's house, Sukhada Kunj, where he has indeed installed the Empress Tulsi on a throne, where he worshipped Gaur Gadadhar, where he looked out of his window across the Jalangi and saw the Adbhuta Mandir in the fields of Mayapur, where he had a vision that all of us, brought by his son's disciple, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, that we would be singing and dancing Jai Sachinandana Gaurhari, and that our material disqualifications would be of no matter, of no consequence. that even those in the other sampradayas, even members of the Sri Sampradaya, so rigid in their material qualification, all by hereditary, you know, in the Sri Sampradaya, you can only worship the deity if you're born in an Archita family. You can only give Bhagavatam classes if you're born in a Bhagavatam class-giving family. You can only carry the palanquin of the Lord if you're born in a palanquin-carrying family. And even those people, they've said, oh, let us join the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur envisioned. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote so much about the universal nature of Krishna consciousness. After all, it is Sanatana Dharma. It is the eternal religion. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote about not hating anyone from any religion or any background, but being all-inclusive. All-inclusive doesn't mean that you compromise. It doesn't mean anybody can do anything, but it means anybody can surrender to the Lord. And anyone can enter into their eternal relationship with the Lord. In fact, sometimes the acharyas say, because I am the most disqualified, my claim is first, I am the most fallen. So this was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings, at least in my opinion, are very much at the core of what Srila Prabhupada did in his Hare Krishna movement. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision and his perspective. I mean, also, of course, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's perspective. And it's of note that each acharya, although their guru is one, so they have their personality. But we find that Bhaktivinoda, although Bhaktisiddhanta's perspective, particularly in regard to book distribution and lion-like preaching against the impersonalists, is also very prevalent in Prabhupada's mood. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision of society, his vision of Varnashram, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision of everyone being able to take up Krishna consciousness and taking up the process of devotion, is very visible throughout ISKCON, throughout Srila Prabhupada's preaching, throughout Srila Prabhupada's purports. In fact, when you read the Thakur's books, they're almost indistinguishable from Srila Prabhupada's books in their mood, in their language, in their view. And of course, Gadadhar Pandit was one of the worshipful deities of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Bhaktivinoda Thakur did not worship Gaur-Nitai, he worshipped Gaur Gadadhar. He wrote many songs about the worship of Gaur Gadadhar. And both Lord Nityananda and Gadadhar Pandit, they are both considered original guru. And in many ways, each of them have moods which is directing our life. Lord Nityananda was rescuing Jaghai and Madhai and bringing low persons to Krishna consciousness. And Gadadhar Pandit was not as involved in that aspect of Krishna consciousness. He was involved in reading Bhagavatam, serving Gopinath, and so forth. But it is, of course, the mood of Gadadhar, that of Srimati Radharani, which is this mood of compassion and all-inclusiveness and wanting to give love of God to everyone. This is the mood of Gadadhar Pandit exemplified in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the best way that we can remember the personalities of Gadadhar Pandit and Bhaktivinoda Thakur is not just in reading their lives and knowing the plot. Srila Prabhupada was not very interested in just the plots of a story. I don't know what the plot is. He did this, he did that, he went there, he saw this, he saw that. That was not so much his interest. In fact, in the early days of the movement, when all we had were the first canto Bhagavatam, Hayagriva wanted to get a summary of the Bhagavatam stories from, I think it was the Sri Chinmoy people, anyway, some other organization. And Prabhupada said, we're not interested just in the plots of the stories. We're interested in the philosophy. Even though the devotees didn't know all the plots of the stories then. So just to tell the story of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life, which of course we could do, had we the time, and the story of Gadadhar Pandit's life, which again, if had we the time, we could do. That's not, although that's a very wonderful way to meditate on them, the deepest way is to take up what is their mood and follow in their mood. With Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it's very easy to do that because we have so many of his songs and so many of his writings, as we did at the beginning of this class, trying to enter into the mood of Jayarada Madhava and trying to enter into that mood from the view of a resident of Mayapur or Jagannath Puri, particularly Gadadhar Pandit in Jagannath Puri, entering into the mood of that song from somebody who's at Kurukshetra, trying to bring the Lord back to Vrindavan. So it's very easy for us to enter into Bhaktivinoda Thakur's mood because he's opened so many doors and windows into the room of his heart. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written very intimately, very, very intimately, really following in the mood of, say, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur or Raghunath Das Goswami about his relationship with Krishna at the end of, I think it's Gita Mala. Yeah, at the end of Gita Mala, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is describing how he goes from a devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu into entering into his form as a Manjari and getting all of the 11 items of his identity and entering into service of Radha and Krishna. So he's very much opening his innermost chambers of his heart. So certainly we can get to know him very well. With Gadadhar Pandit, a little bit more difficult. We have, of course, the descriptions of Gadadhar Pandit from Chaitanya Charitamrita and Chaitanya Bhagavat, how Gadadhar Pandit was so much in love with reading the Bhagavatam that his tears would wash away the print on Bhagavatam. How he was a constant companion of the Lord in Navadvip. How he was so devoted to his worship of the deity, but just like the gopis would leave their husbands and run to the forest, so Gadadhar Pandit, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left Puri, he gave up all of his vows to follow the Lord, to be with the Lord. So on this day, we can meditate on Gadadhar Pandit and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, on the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as exemplified by Srila Prabhupada, to take this principle spoken 5,000 years ago, before the advent of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, spoken by the ladies in Hastinapur, about how anybody from any position can at once and immediately become sadhu and glorified simply by surrender. And the main way that we can enter into all of these and enter into this mood is by surrendering ourselves, by throwing ourselves at the feet of Guru and Gauranga, throwing ourselves at the feet of Krishna and saying with meaning, with sincerity, from this day on, my Lord, I am yours. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements?
All right, Prabhu, if you have any questions or comments, otherwise, please remain muted.
Thank you so much. That's very, very enlightening. And I'm glad to get a better understanding of, what it meant, women without individuality. That I was very confused about that. So thank you. Such an enlightening class.
Thank you, Mother Amala. I wanted to tell you, I really especially liked your talking about something I've never really heard, is the unlevel playing field. That was really enlightening. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that a second time. I've just never heard that discussion before, ever. And it sounded right on. I really liked it.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's what Prabhupada is referring to in this first paragraph. He's referring to the fact that we don't have a level playing field. And at the same time, in a sense, we do. Because anyone who surrenders is immediately at the same platform as anyone else who surrenders. But the problem is that we may find surrender in certain areas to be very difficult. And my entreaty is, and I'm speaking to myself, give up envy and just accept. I'm in the position I am because of my own choices. And I may not remember all of my choices. I they may not be in my conscious awareness, but doesn't matter. I'm in the position I am because of my own choices. And certain things in this particular lifetime, certain aspects of surrender to Krishna are going to be harder for me than they are for somebody who made different choices. And live with it. And be honest. And adjust accordingly. And one may have to do some austerities in a certain area that, frankly, someone else doesn't have to do. And in some ways, one may not have to do austerities in a certain area that someone else may have to do. And that's, it's ultimately fair. It's ultimately fair because it's the result of our own choices. You always add something wonderful, Vidagdhamadava Prabhu.
Okay. The Sanskrit word, paska peshalam.
Uh-huh.
So it means without cunning, without independence, or surrender, is that?
Okay, let me go back to the... So, apasta means without or having been discarded, gone. So it can mean gone... Being discarded without. The word peshalam has several meanings. It can mean good fortune or auspiciousness. It can mean independence and following one's own will. Or it can mean craft or charm. So the most literal meaning of peshala is craft or charm. That's its most literal meaning. And it can also mean independence or following one's own will. And as I said, it can also mean fortune or auspiciousness. So what we can determine here is that basically these women surrendered. They voluntarily gave up their own individual, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this, let me do what Krishna wants. Another possible interpretation, and this is now my interpretation, is that these women were married as a group. So Krishna married his first eight wives individually, and they were the circumstances of their being won by Krishna and being married by Krishna were all individual, whereas the 16,100 wives, and they are the specific topic of this verse, were all accepted as a group. Now, although they had individual weddings, those weddings all took place on the same day. And Krishna expanded himself. So it is possible, and again, this is Urmila's interpretation, so let's take it like that, is that this word refers to that factor, that they were accepted together and they were married together. They weren't accepted one by one as the first eight queens were.
You just articulated exactly what I was going to say. The common sense interpretation of this verse, if you look at the context, is all these women auspiciously glorified their lives despite their being without individuality. And so despite their being without individuality, I would take the first, you know, the good fortune, peshalam, you know, the good fortune, if you were going to go to the Sanskrit, but your common sense interpretation of this, what that meant, is exactly what it seems like it meant. We don't hear of them by name or as individuals, and neither did the ladies on the balcony. You know, they were all, it was a mass wedding. They were accepted as a group. So it's they lack this individuality that we hear of the principal queens, the famous ones, Rukmini, Satyabhama, Jambavati, Kalindi, Mitravinda, you know, Nagajitta, Bhadra, and Lakshana. So they've all, you know, everybody knows them. They're individuals, but the 16,000, it's just a group, right, that lacks individuality. One thing, being around Shurashita Maharshi, I'm aware of this Kurukshetra pastime. It came up a lot in connection with Bhakti Vinod and also Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. You know, they gave some deference or preference to this leela where there's this need for service. You know, Radharani's, you know, there's union, but there's separation at the same time, and
Jaya Pandit to give up his sannyas dress and come back to Srivas's house so they could have a big kirtan together. That was also Bhaktivinoda's mood. And the Gaudiya devotees, they worship Nimai Pandit of Navadvip rather than Lord Chaitanya as a renunciate in Puri or Nilachal. So, you know, our very worship of Mahaprabhu is this kirtan, is Srivasangam. And that's the mood of Bhaktivinoda, to bring it back. And, you know, a lot of these devotees had that sentiment. They wanted to give up to him, to throw that down. I mean, Nityananda broke it up in three pieces and threw it away. And, you know, a lot of the devotees didn't want him to do this sannyas leela. And one last thing.
I should just say that you have really immersed all of us in an ocean of sweetness by that particular edition. I'm falling at your feet in gratitude. Thank you.
Here, I don't want to get in trouble now that I've done something good, finally. But, you know, we're talking, you know, it's a sorry kata, so let's, you know. So, I appreciate a lot of things you said in the class. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to talk about. And, but Prabhupada made the point different places in his books and also in the conversations that once a lady surrenders to Krishna, we are not judging her in that way. You know, if he has something to say about women, it's the persons that are, you know, identifying with the body, you know, the particular, and everything that goes along with it.
Yes.
So, I am totally on board with that, but what I keep hearing is, it sounds like you're just throwing a switch, you know, one minute you're, you know, you're a bodily identified soul, and the next minute you just threw the switch, you're Krishna conscious. And I've always had an issue with this. I think there's a gradation here, and it takes time. It may take a lifetime. It may take lifetimes. Not that it isn't possible for someone to perfect in this lifetime, because we all have a past. We all have lifetimes together, and many of us connected with devotional service in our past lives. So we're picking it up where we left off. So some devotees, they're like shooting stars, and suddenly, you know, they're giving class to everybody out of nowhere after a few years. And there's other devotees that just struggle, you know, to reach the standard of just following the basic principles and chanting their rounds. So there's a gradation of devotees here, and so when you talk broadly about this, you have to also bring it down to the individual level, you know, because like you said to Maharani in the last class, that there's as many reasons for someone to leave Krishna consciousness as there are people, you know, so there's all this individuality in that we're dealing with. And so a lot of us are in a mixed condition, you know, and you pointed that out in the class that, you know, you knew some renunciates that were one way and some really nice devotees that had other problems. So everybody's got their problems. And so everybody's in a mixed condition. And so that also plays into this problem of the, you know, this discrimination or this abuse of women. I mean, the women and the children, I believe, should have been taken care of much better than they were. And there was a lot of stress and renunciation during Prabhupada's time. And so that's part of how some of this happened, but also the immaturity and the lack of Krishna consciousness and the lack of compassion of certain individuals certainly caused some of these problems. But even today, when we present this before the committees or whatever, you know, to try to right the ship, we have to be aware that not everybody's an individual. Everybody's at a certain stage. There's so many levels to this. And it's not a switch where one minute you're materially absorbed and the next minute you're just absolutely Krishna conscious. You know, there's choices to make at every moment.
Well, thank you. Yes, I want to thank you very much for bringing that up. Obviously, in any one class, you can't emphasize everything. It's just not possible. So in any one discourse, certain things are going to be simplified, and simplification always entails distortion. So, you know, you focus on certain aspects at a particular time. As far as is there a switch, there's a time when there's a switch. You know, and it can be the matter of a moment, and it can be an instant. For most people, is it? No. And for most people, that moment of switch and that moment of instant comes after a long time of gradual and proportional, and some slipping back and some slipping forward and things like that. It's just like, is there a moment at which you've graduated from school? It's a moment. There's a switch. Now you've graduated. There's a moment at which you're married, when you weren't married before. There's a moment at which the child was born. So there is a moment at which one comes to full Krishna consciousness. And that usually happens after a prolonged gradual advancement at where people are in different levels. Not always, and it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. There was the story of the son of Maharaj Prataparudra, who got Kripa Siddhi, and he went instantly from being a materialistic person to a fully pure devotee, self-realized soul. And Prabhupada comments on that in the purport. It is also a fact that as soon as you surrender to Krishna, you are instantly under the Lord's protection. You're in a different category. And I was talking with my grandkids yesterday. We're talking how Krishna gives us everything we need. And then one of them says, he also gives us everything we want, but we may have to work for it. And then the question comes up again, well, but why does he give us things that we want that are not good for us? And Krishna only gives the devotees things they want that are good for them. But to non-devotees, he gives things they want that are not good for them. But then they're not under Krishna's personal protection anymore. Like when your child's living at home, you'll only let them have things they want that are good for them. You know, if they want to be a drug addict, they have to leave home and be a drug addict outside of the home and take their own responsibility. So once somebody's surrendered to Krishna, they're under Krishna's personal supervision, and he's directing their life, and that is a switch. That is an immediate thing. Of course, punarmustika bhava, one can, if one really desires, go back. But for most of us, yes, it's gradual and proportionate, as Prabhupada's words, gradual and proportionate. And the areas in which each of us were the most in sattva-gun or transcendence in previous lives are probably going to be the areas in this life where our Krishna consciousness is the easiest. And the areas in which we made poor choices in previous lives or in the beginning of this life are going to be the areas in which we have to work harder, and we have to do more austerities, and we have to do more struggle, and we may have a tendency to backslide and to mess up. And those areas are very different for different people. So as far as policies in a society, I see that there are two extreme groups, and then there's people who are more rational. So one extreme group says, until you're totally, completely, fully, 100% on the transcendental platform, which arguably could be at Nista, at Ruchi, at Bhava, or at Prema, depending on how you want to define the transcendental platform, you should be judged and you should be engaged strictly according to your birth and according to your body. So these are the people who say women should never give Bhagavatam class unless there's an emergency, and so forth and so on. We wouldn't have a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of things to spread Krishna consciousness if we actually had a society that was geared like that, where until you were on a liberated platform, you were 100% judged by the circumstances of your birth and of how you lived your life. Then we have another group that says, as soon as somebody claims to be a devotee of Krishna, as soon as someone says, yes, I'm a devotee of Krishna, then they should all be given equal facility to do everything. So without any consideration of one's previous birth. And some people also in this group, they want to artificially level the playing field and say, okay, well, let's change the rules so that nobody has it harder than others. And that doesn't work very well either. A little bit further down from that is people who say, all right, well, anybody who's strictly following the process should have equal accessibility to all services. Now, my understanding is a little different than either of those extreme positions, and I understand it based on Bhagavad Gita 9:30, and there's one other place which I keep meaning to look up again, and I can't find it. I just haven't done it yet. It's either in Ishopanishad or in NOI. I'll have to look it up. Where Prabhupada talks, I'm sure there's other places too, where Prabhupada talks about two swadharmas, that we have a swadharma according to our body and mind, and we have a swadharma according to ourself as a soul. So my own understanding of how this plays out in a society is that when it comes to the swadharma of the soul, which is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, that everyone should have an equal opportunity, and if you are strictly following the process of sadhana bhakti and duly initiated, that you should also have an equal opportunity to anything for the realm of the initiated, first, second initiated, regardless of your bodily situation. So if you're strictly following the process and you're properly initiated, then anything that's available to properly initiated devotees should be given to you in those realms of the nine processes of devotional service. So equal access to Archanam, equal access to Kirtanam, equal access to Shravanam. Regardless, you're a man, you're a woman, you're black, you're white, you're purple, you're green, you're deformed, you're in a wheelchair, you're mentally retarded, you're mentally ill, whatever. And then when it comes to the other areas, the Krishnaized activities, where the iron rod put in the fire. So I distinguish between the fire and the iron rod put in the fire. In the area of fire, the qualification is one strict adherence to the process. When it comes to the iron rod put in the fire, then you have to distinguish what's the shape of the iron rod. So one of us has one shaped iron rod and one of us has another shaped iron rod, and it's all according to Bhagavad Gita 4:24. It all becomes Brahman, it all becomes transcendental, it all becomes bhakti. It's all on fire, but the shape is going to be different. So that's in regard to, you know, are you a man or a woman? Are you Indian or American? Are you old or young? Are you a genius or retarded? Are you crippled or are you a muscle man? When disregard to those things. And in regard to that, you know, 5-year-olds can't drive cars. 12-year-olds can't drive cars, but a 12-year-old could give Bhagavatam class. A 12-year-old could worship the deity if they were properly situated and properly initiated. So when it comes to the iron rod put in the fire, then there's different things for men and women. And when it regard to the fire, then it's in regard to how much you're strictly following. That's my own suggestion as far as how to practically apply in a preaching society the fact that our advancement is gradual and proportionate, and that there are certain areas of our life in which we are very firm and very realized, and there are certain areas of our life in which we really have to keep irrigating and putting on that fertilizer. And if we mess up for a day, man, our plants start to wither. So that's my own humble suggestion on it. And I also look at how Srila Prabhupada practically engaged people. Prabhupada engaged, we're talking about men and women, which is appropriate for these verses. Prabhupada engaged both men and women in leading kirtan. Prabhupada engaged both men and women in giving Bhagavatam classes, Bhagavad Gita classes. Prabhupada engaged both men and women in deity worship. Prabhupada engaged both men and women in preaching to the public and in book distribution. He engaged both men and women in kirtan. He engaged both men and women in study. He engaged both men and women in full surrender. When it came to the spiritualized activities, he very much discriminated and said men should do these things in offering to Krishna, women should do these things. Obviously, the men aren't going to get pregnant and breastfeed the babies. And as soon as you have a normal society, then there are going to be babies. And then there's going to be a natural division of the duties of men and women, at least from, you know, age 20 to 50. And that's just, if you follow a natural life, that's going to be there. And I think each of us also need to look at ourselves and be honest. In what areas am I still really struggling with my conditioned nature? And what areas do I really, really need to be careful? And I really got to take care of my little garden, because if I don't, it's immediately a desert again. And be honest with ourselves and engage ourselves accordingly under the direction of Guru and Sadhu. So that's a long answer. I'm sure we could talk about these things for years. I do think that people who take extreme positions, they're not even able to talk to each other. And nor are they able to talk to anybody in the middle, and nor are they able to propose any kind of society that's going to be both stable and Krishna conscious. So the people who are extreme with everything for everybody, maybe people can go towards Krishna consciousness, but society falls apart. And the people who just, okay, until you're fully liberated, you've just got to work on the material platform, they might have a materially stable society, but people aren't going to be progressing in Krishna consciousness. So, sorry for that long answer, and I probably made another 10 people furious with it, but...
Last night I was talking to Ramananda Prabhu and Yugala Rasadidi about this specific point. It seems like everything's so polarized and politicized that there can't be the voice of reason or some constructive criticism or some dialogue, meaningful dialogue, to change anything. It seems like people are taking these extreme sorts of positions, and it's very difficult to change things in such an atmosphere.
Well, I would say in my own experience that the people who are the most polarized are just often the most vocal, and the balanced, sane people tend to just say, I'm not going to open my mouth. I'm just going to go about my business. And my own experience is that the majority of people have common sense. The majority of people I see who are practicing devotees of Krishna have a lot of common sense and a lot of balance, and try to read Prabhupada's books in total and read the books of the acharyas in total. They don't just pull things out of context, and they look at life as it is, and they look at people as they are, and see how the scriptures relate to reality and how reality relates to the scriptures, instead of trying to force some kind of an extreme position artificially on everybody. So most people I find are actually like that. But the people who make a lot of noise tend to be those who are polarized, and we could get into why that's true. And I would say because if you're polarized, you're probably more impacted by the mode of ignorance and passion. And unfortunately, the people on the polar ends of any debate also sometimes shift policy just because they are so noisy, and they can sometimes be threatening. So they will sometimes get a bunch of their people, and they'll threaten legal action, or they'll threaten financial action, or they're tend to be very aggressive. And so sometimes even leaders who are sane and stable will make adjustments to please these people, just kind of like giving your kid a sweet ball so they'll stop crying. So unfortunately that goes on, that these very vocal people who don't accurately represent Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, nor do they even accurately represent common sense and everyday life experience, and nor could any of their policies be used to guide any kind of society more than above 3 or 4 people, that sometimes they shift policy just by their volume. What did somebody say to me the other day? In Kali Yuga, volume is truth. So, you know, if you're loud enough and you're frequent enough, people may just move a little bit simply to placate you. But I do not see that those are the ones who are doing the main shifts in policy. They have an effect. Unfortunately, they have an effect, each of the polarizing sides. They're not without effect, and they know that, which is, I suppose, why they keep up the screaming. Okay, any other points?
Any place I could read that? I'm very interested in that subject.
Read about Jambavati what? I'm sorry?
Not being a bear or a monkey, not being an animal.
Oh, yeah, okay. Let me, there's a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Jadarani on that subject matter. So I'm not sure if I can find it quickly, but it should be in the Vedabase under correspondence. Jambavan. Maybe I'm not spelling it right. Oh, here we go. I found it immediately. Just see. Krishna's pleased with your question. This is a letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote on June 4th, 1970 to Jadarani, Bhardwaj, and Muralidhar, to the artists. He said, Jambavan, the name does not suggest a bear because his daughter was one of the queens of Dwarka married by Krishna. Just like sometime our name is Krishna, that does not mean that I am real Krishna, but I am Krishna Das, or servant of Krishna. From the description of Srimad Bhagavatam, we understand that this Jambavan was very sturdy and strong fighter. Sometimes we get such picture of bodily construction of a black man in your country. So in this way, you can guess what should be the features of his body, but certainly he was not a bear. Okay, anybody else? I think there's another letter too. I don't think that's the only one, but anyway, there's at least that one.
One more comment. I think the word retarded is a little like up there with the M word. People that are retarded, they get very offended. So mentally challenged is a good alternative.
Mentally challenged. All right. Or also I've read developmentally delayed. But developmentally delayed sounds like they're going to catch up eventually.
I had one last question. I hate to take us back to the playing field, but it really interested me. As you were sort of commenting on my comment of appreciating what you're talking about, is you said that, well, the playing field is both not level and level at the same time. Could you go over that, please?
Okay, the playing field is level in the sense that anybody who fully surrenders to Krishna is at once liberated, and that can be the matter of one moment. It can be. Prabhupada said that many times. Prabhupada will use the words like immediately, at once. It is possible. So in that respect, the playing field is level. Anybody from any position has the capability, the innate capability of immediately surrendering to Krishna and immediately being on the highest platform. It doesn't happen very often. It's not the norm. It's not to be expected. But it is possible. And we have stories of such happening to people. It is possible. Like Megrari the hunter, yes, that's an excellent example. Excellent example, because Megrari the hunter was on a very low position and he came to full Krishna consciousness very quickly. I don't know if it was instantaneous, but it certainly was not a very long time. Another really good example is the prostitute who was trying to deter Haridas Thakur from his practice. She's interesting because, okay, she's a woman, not a man. She's a very low-class woman. You know, either she's a Sudrani or she's less than a Sudrani. I mean, she was really a prostitute. Sometimes Prabhupada uses the word prostitute, as he explains, to refer to just an unmarried girlfriend. But she was a professional prostitute, the way any of us would use that word. And not only was she a prostitute, I mean, even in modern society, professional, you know, as they call them now, sex workers, if we're going to be politically correct. So sex workers don't have a very glorious position in society, although maybe that'll change, I don't know. But anyway, so she was that. And not only that, she was willing for money to try to cause the fall down of a sadhu, which is certainly Vaishnava aparad. Just imagine if you're so envious, Ramachandra Khan was so envious of Haridas Thakur, he wanted to make him fall down. You know, sticking out your foot to trip somebody. And she was willing to participate in that for money. So that's pretty bad. You know, it's really pretty low life. But she did have one very good quality from her upbringing, and that is that she knew to immediately offer obeisances to Tulsi Devi. And then she also had, she had some etiquette. So when Haridas Thakur was chanting, she was waiting. Now, I don't believe that she became a pure devotee instantaneously, but it was, again, very quickly. So after she surrenders to Haridas and he instructs her, she shaves her head, gives away her possessions to the Brahmin, puts on just one cloth, and she sits by Tulsi and chants incessantly. And she very quickly became such an elevated devotee that it said the stalwart Vaishnavas would come to see her. I would assume they wouldn't just come to look at her, but they would come to discuss Krishna consciousness with her or hear her realization. So those are two examples of somebody who was very low and became on a high transcendental platform very, very quickly. So in that way, it's a level playing field, that even if you're very, very low, if you surrender fully, you can come to the highest platform either instantly or very, very quickly. Those are, however, the exceptions. And in most cases, the fact that we start off with an unlevel, uneven playing field is of consequence in how we progress in our spiritual life. It does matter for most of us. It matters in the sense that some of us have an easier time with some things than other people have with those very things. And that each of us has an unevenness in our own life as to what parts of Krishna consciousness are easy for us and what parts of Krishna consciousness are a struggle for us. And, you know, I've given a few analogies. One is different transparency levels of windows. Another is different distance from a door, how far you have to walk to get to the door. I've also given the examples of different types of soil. We could also say that in different soil, certain plants will grow better than others. So we also see that, you know, to have a garden where all aspects of bhakti will easily grow is very unusual. Generally, each of us find that certain aspects of bhakti grow very easily in our soil. And other aspects of bhakti, we have to really work at the soil to get it to grow. So I think the same course for most of us would be regarding ourselves to be very honest and very humble, at least to ourselves. We don't have to be very honest and very humble with everybody in the universe, but at least with ourselves and with our guru and with Krishna, very honest and very humble, that these are the areas that are fairly easy for me, and these are the areas that are fairly difficult for me, and how am I going to structure my own individual life to make my situation the most conducive for Krishna consciousness. As far as others, a lot of compassion and not judgment. Because just because somebody else struggles with something that I don't, guess what? I struggle with something that somebody else doesn't. And that's just the way it is. I have not met a person who struggles with nothing. I haven't met such a person. If you find such a person, please introduce me to them. That would be Anicca Siddha, who's appeared on the planet to preach. You know, but that's my experience, is that we all have something. There's something that caused us to take birth again, unless we just came here to preach. Some kind of attachment. You see this in the kids born in the movement also. You really see it in them. Sometimes in the kids born in the movement, it's a huge disparity between their extreme receptivity to spiritual life in some areas and their extreme attachments in others. I see sometimes a very wide disparity in second generation. I'm thinking of someone I know, and I hope that the identity of this person is not revealed, but I know of somebody who actually remembers their previous lives. But I know of somebody who's a great scholar in Sanskrit and Bengali, to whom austerity, renunciation, and celibacy come like breathing, who's a natural guru and a natural teacher, just natural, that's, again, just like breathing, who to study the Shastra, to read the Shastra inside out, backwards and forward, but who took birth in a Western female body and has that as a difficulty sometimes. And also this person had before coming to Krishna consciousness, had been training to be an acharya in mystic yoga, and was very adept at mystic yoga. This person had awakened kundalini and developed mystic powers and all sorts of things from mystic yoga, which in coming to Krishna consciousness became an impediment, and has ended up, this person has to spend 1 or 2 hours a day keeping everything in balance, because they were dealing with having awakened all sorts of energies which now have to be taken care of. They can't just ignore them. You know, it's so that this, I see that this person has certain things that are difficult and a struggle, and other things that are just easy and natural. So this is, you know, I could give an example from the life of almost anyone I know, from my own life. So I think with ourself, honesty and humility, and with others, compassion and freedom from judgment. From judgment, I mean self-righteous judgment. I'm better than you. And always understanding that, you know, also a person may have trouble, a lot of trouble in one area, but in every other area, be very realized. And although they may struggle a lot with one area, they may be very, very close to full Krishna consciousness. It's not something that you can really... Just be careful. We have general scriptural principles, and then we have individual applications. And we should be very, very careful. You know, Krishna consciousness is custom-made clothes. It's not off-the-rack clothes. It's a real custom-made outfit here. And, you know, this is a tailor shop where people are taking our measurements and they're fitting the clothes to our needs. You cannot shove everyone's body into an off-the-rack garment. It just doesn't work. It isn't like that. And I think, you know, we have a duty to preach general principles. The Shastra preaches general principles. The Acharya preaches general principles. But in our application, we'd better do it individually. Therefore, it need Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, all three. Shastra gives general principles, and it also gives stories of how individuals applied those general principles to their personal lives. The Sadhus exemplify the application of general principles to their personal lives, and they also preach both general principles and personal applications. And then the gurus in our life, and I'm using it plural because Krishna uses it plural in 434, the gurus in our life are Diksha Guru, our Shiksha Gurus, our the gurus even of the birds and the trees and the bangles on a lady's arm, and all of the gurus in our life. But we should have gurus in our life who help us to make a personal application. How do I take this general principle? How do I take the examples of personal application? And how do I fit it to me? How do I fit it to me now? How do I fit it to me 10 years from now, which may be different to how I fit it to me now? How do I, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, as we go up the stairs, the rules change. How, as I progress, do I avoid the rules of the former step being chains around my feet? And without doing that, then we don't really have a personal, individual philosophy. I think I had better go now. I have some chores I have to do in the house. But this has been lovely. I want to thank everybody for helping me to churn this nectar and giving me the opportunity to engage in kirtan. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Jai Bhagavatam. Jai Giridhar Pandit. Jai Bhaktivinoda Thakur.